From the Cabinet Room of the White House in Washington, D.C., the combined radio and television networks present the first broadcast ever to be made of an actual Cabinet session. President Dwight D. Eisenhower will be here in just a moment. With him will be the Secretary of State, John Foster Dulles, who arrived in Washington earlier today from Paris. In addition to Mr. Dulles, 9 other members of the Cabinet will be present. Vice President Richard M. Nixon is unavoidably detained in Idaho. Harold E. Stassen, Director of the Foreign Operations Administration, is in Europe. We're expecting momentarily the members of the President's Cabinet to enter the Cabinet Room here at the White House. We'll have, in addition to the members of the Cabinet, the members of the small Cabinet. Coming in the room now are Arthur S. Fleming, Director of the Office of Defense Mobilization, Philip Young, the Chairman of the Civil Service Commission, Roland Hughes, Director of the Budget, the Secretary of Labor, Mr. Mitchell, the Postmaster General, Mr. Sommerfeld, Mrs. Ovita Kopp-Hobby, the Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare, Secretary Weeks of Commerce, the Attorney General Brownell, Secretary Humphrey, Secretary McKay. Down on the far end of the table are Secretary Wilson, Secretary Benson, the Ambassador to the United Nations, Henry Cabot Lodge, Herbert Hoover, Jr., the Undersecretary of State, and the President's staff members, Mr. Persons, Mr. Rabb, and Governor Adams. And now, ladies and gentlemen, the Secretary of State, John Foster Dulles, the President of the United States.
Mrs. Hobby and gentlemen, as you know, I ask you to come here this evening so that we could immediately hear a first-hand report from the Secretary of State regarding the negotiations that have just been going on in Europe and the outcome of those negotiations. I think it is extremely important that all of us have a clear understanding of what was accomplished and the circumstances under which it was done and what it will probably mean. Having determined upon this, when request was made to me that we open this meeting to the television companies, the radio companies, and the newsreels, it suddenly occurred to me that for tonight, there's one subject, a very special one, about which to talk, and one in which the American people, all of them, without regard to race or party or creed or color or any other thing, will want to hear. So for this one time, we are having this meeting of the Cabinet on all of these immediate publicity. Secretary Dulles.
Mr. President, I certainly greatly appreciate this chance to make an early report to you and my Cabinet colleagues and the American people about the events which culminated in Paris last Saturday, day before yesterday. I believe that the importance of these events justifies their immediate consideration by the American nation. I realize how difficult it is when you're right in the midst of things to make a sound judgment. But it is my honest opinion that history will not soon forget the results which came about, culminated in Paris last Saturday. At the beginning of September, things looked pretty dark. The plan for the European defense community had collapsed, and it looked as though the whole North Atlantic treaty structure, its whole system, might be undermined and even swept away by political decisions and uncertainties. And this shattering blow in Europe came just at a moment when we had not yet completed our long-conceived project for unity in Southeast Asia. We had a plan for a conference, as you will recall, to be held in Manila early in September, but that conference had not yet been held. The first big decision we had to take, you'll recall, was whether or not to go ahead with this Manila project for the Southeast Asia Treaty, or whether to drop everything and rush over to Europe to try to deal with that situation. We all felt that we ought to go ahead with this Southeast Asia plan. I'm sure that our Asian allies would have understandably felt very sensitive, very much hurt, if we had, as soon as trouble arose in Europe, dropped all our plans for consultation with them. So we went ahead with the Manila Conference, and as you'll recall, it was held, I think, between the 2nd and 9th of September, and out of that came the Southeast Asian Treaty and the Pacific Charter, whereby the members of that conference, the Asian and European Western nations, join in proclaiming their determination to have peace, security, independence, and freedom for the nations of Southeast Asia. When that phase of our policy had been completed, then I felt free to go to Europe to make a first-hand study there of the situation which had resulted through the untimely death of the European Defense Community Treaty. And I was fortunate in a position to go there with considerable authority behind me, because not only did we have an executive position, but also we had a position which had been approved by the United States Senate by a unanimous nonpartisan vote. It was a very extraordinary demonstration of cooperation and nonpartisan action on the part of the Senate. You'll recall the Senate, before it recessed last August, had unanimously passed this resolution, which had called upon you, to the extent of your executive powers, that if the European Defense Community Treaty failed, to proceed to try to restore sovereignty to Germany and to arrange for the contribution of Germany to the maintenance of international peace and security. And with this backing and with your guidance, I then made a quick trip to Europe. And I went first to Bonn, where I talked to Chancellor Adenauer, because I wanted to get his views, because he has all along been a stout, stalwart advocate of European unity. By the way, you know he'll be here day after tomorrow, and I know he'll receive here the welcome which the American people ought to pay to a great statesman such as he is. Then after that day in Bonn, I went on to London, where I talked with Sir Winston Churchill and Mr. Eden. I guess, say Sir Anthony Eden now. I always, so recent that I sort of forget the handle. He had jumped in with great vigor and imagination to try to pick up the pieces that were left scattered by the untimely death of this European Defense Community Treaty. And at that point, we had to take another important decision of a procedural character, which was whether to go right ahead with the European conferences or to delay so as to allow the United Nations General Assembly to get going. It was about to meet, and while it had been suggested that we should go right ahead in Europe without regard to the United Nations Assembly, we felt and concluded that we ought not to have a meeting in Europe which would compete with and distract attention from this opening of the United Nations Assembly. So we arranged with Mr. Eden that the European conference would not be called until after the General Assembly had been in session for about a week, and that enabled me to get back here and to appear in the so-called opening debate of the General Assembly. And I had the chance at that time to develop further, Mr. President, your plan for the dedication of atomic energy through an international agency to constructive purposes. That is going on, I think.
Perhaps I could interrupt to say that your plan for the peaceful uses of atomic energy is regarded by most people at the United Nations as the greatest single proposal to increase the well-being of humanity, and that I hope that steps will be taken at this session to promote it and give it effect.
Thank you. Well, I think it was well worthwhile to have gotten that project underway at this assembly. And I think that the delay that occurred between the 1st of September and the 28th of September was by no means wasted as far as Europe was concerned, because it gave time for some much needed sobering second thoughts, and it gave time for pondering about how to go about picking up the pieces that had been left after EDC collapsed. Then on September 28th, we did have this meeting in Paris of the 9 foreign ministers, the representatives of the 6 countries which had been expected to form the European Defense Community. That was France and Germany and Italy, Belgium, Netherlands, and Luxembourg. And then in addition, there was the United Kingdom and Canada and the United States. And when we met there, gathered around a table, much like this, we all, I think, had the feeling that our gathering was going to be momentous from the standpoint of history. And the critical day of the conference came on the second day, on Wednesday, when the United Kingdom and I for the United States made a statement of our positions. I was the first of the two to speak. And I pointed out to our colleagues there the history of the United States' action in relation to Europe. both our positive action and our negative action. And I said that whenever Europe was really working to get together in unity and strength, then American help was outgiving. And we were very generous in what we did. But I said that when Europe goes in the other direction, and tends to be divisive and quarrelsome and to recreate the recurrent cycle of war, then we pull away. And I said at the moment there was a great wave of disillusionment that had swept all over the United States. But I said, if it is possible to find a new pattern of unity and strength so that the hopes which we had all placed in this European defense community could honorably and honestly be transferred to a new organization, then, I said, I would recommend to you, Mr. President, that you would renew the same statement of policy which you had made last April in relation to the European defense community, namely under those circumstances, that we would continue to bear a fair share of the burden of the defense of Europe so long as the danger persisted. And I concluded by saying there to my colleagues, I believe that if you will do that and come together for strength, then you will continue to find that the American flag will fly beside yours in Europe. And then Mr. Eden followed with a very generous tribute to the help that the United States had given, and he went on to make an historic commitment. He said that the United Kingdom was prepared to join the continental countries, not only to create a Council of Western European Union, but also that he was prepared to commit to the continent of Europe the four British divisions that are now there, plus a tactical air force, on the understanding that they could not be removed as against the opposition of the Brussels Council on European Union. Now, of course, that declaration, as you know, marked a very momentous change in British foreign policy. For a century or more, the British have always avoided any fixed continental commitments. They've given primacy to their Commonwealth policy. The effect of these two statements by the United States and by the United Kingdom was very profound, and it led to a very immediate response. All around the table, people spoke up. Canada immediately followed with a declaration of its intention to back the European unity. And then the other countries, in turn, expressed their recognition of the profound significance of what had been said and their determination to respond to it. And from that moment on, all of us in London felt that we were bound to succeed. The difficulties ahead were still enormous, and by normal standards would have seemed insuperable. But all of a sudden, these very difficult problems seemed to become of secondary importance because the reward for success had mounted to unexpected heights and the price of failure had become prohibitive. And then we really went to work. And by the next Sunday, between Wednesday and Sunday, we had reached agreement on four basic propositions. The first was that sovereignty would be restored to the Federal German Republic. The second was that Western European unity would be developed, this time through a Council of Western European Union, which would be established under the old Brussels Treaty of 1948. The members of that treaty and the Council to consist of the same six countries as would have been members of the European Defense Community with the addition of the United Kingdom. Then the third place, it was agreed that this council that I speak of would set up the machinery to control the military strength of its members so that there wouldn't be any excessive rearmament. These controls were to be on a non-discriminatory basis, and the purpose would be to assure that the agreed force goals, which are supervised very largely, as you know, by SACUR, the North Atlantic Treaty Supreme Commander, that these agreed force goals would not be exceeded in any country in terms either of their land, naval, or air forces, or in terms of the military equipment, armament, ammunition, and the like, which was prepared for them. And the fourth proposition was that Germany would be admitted as a full and equal member of the North Atlantic Treaty, something that would not have happened under the European Defense Community plan, by the way. And also that the powers of this Supreme Commander for Europe would be very largely increased so that he could effectively integrate the forces and the facilities of these European continental countries. Well, having reached those decisions, then we recessed so as to give our experts and advisors, who are the real hard workers of all this show, the opportunity to draft the many documents. I've got them here as a pile of the exhibit, which were required to give effect to these agreements in principle that have been arrived at. And we only allowed them a couple of weeks for the task. And that couple of weeks should be compared, I think, with the fact that when the European Defense Community Treaty was being negotiated, they took 12 months to prepare the comparable documents. So you see, we picked up quite a bit of momentum. So after 2 weeks, we met again in Paris from the trip from which I've just returned. And during this interval of 2 weeks, the experts and the technicians had accomplished really an almost superhuman task in getting agreement of the many countries involved, different languages and everything of that sort, to all the necessary documents. And at Paris, we had first a meeting of the four powers, the powers that were directly concerned with the question of German sovereignty. That is, the three occupying powers, Britain, France, and the United States, plus the Federal Republic of Germany itself. And there we approved the various agreements and documents which had to deal with the subject of restoring German sovereignty. Rather complicated subject because a great many things that have been going on during this past 10-year period have got to be wound up in an orderly way. And we decided, which was a fresh decision really, to make a new convention to deal with the stationing of forces in Germany. That's of interest to you, Secretary Wilson. And that convention will mean that the forces stationed there in Germany, instead of being there just as a result of the reserve powers which we got under the Potsdam agreements and the surrender terms, will be there as a result of a fresh agreement made by Germany voluntarily and to be approved by the German responsible parliamentary bodies. So Germany, in that respect, would be just like the other Allied countries. Then after the four had met, then we went on to a meeting of the nine powers, the same nine that had had this meeting in London that I had described. And there we reached a final agreement upon all the documents that would be required to amend the Brussels Treaty, to establish this Council for Western European Unity, to set up the agency for the control of the armed forces and the munitions and equipment and the like, and to define the powers of the Council, which in a considerable respect are in a sense supranational, in the sense that they act by majority vote or less than unanimous vote with respect to many important matters. Then after that came the meeting of the 14 members of the North Atlantic Treaty, acting through their Council of Ministers. And there we unanimously approved of the form of protocol which would invite Germany in as a full and equal member of the North Atlantic Treaty and make Germany a member of the NATO Council. And at the same time, we adopted the resolutions that I anticipated dealing with the increased authority of the Supreme Commander for Europe, General Gunther now, as you know, of course, at the present time, which would give him greater facilities to integrate the forces and the facilities that are assigned to him. So the result is that through these controls, which will partly be exercised through the Brussels Council and its agency, partly through Sacker and his increased powers, there will be an integration, in fact, of the military strength of these continental powers, which will be quite comparable and I think equally effective to that which was to be achieved under the European Defense Community Treaty. Now, turn to another pretty difficult problem, and that was the problem of the Tsar.
Yes, Mr. Zabi.
Tell us how the Tsar agreement was reached. For all you know, that's been one of the most controversial areas in Europe for a long time, almost 100 years.
Mrs. Hobby, it was a tough problem. It was the last problem to be solved, and you can see from the way it was solved how hard it was to get it solved. First place, it was really only a problem directly between France and Germany. Didn't really concern the rest of us and these other arrangements, but the French had taken the position that they wouldn't sign any of these other agreements unless the Tsar problem was solved. And it dragged on and on. We got within about 24 hours of the date when all these things were supposed to be signed up, and there wasn't any agreement. Then on Friday night, Chancellor Adenauer and Mr. Mendes-France went into a session, and they started at 10 o'clock Friday evening, and they sat together until 3 o'clock in the morning. Then they broke up at 3 o'clock in the morning, still turning some of their work over to these famous and hardworking experts. They took a few hours of repose. They went back again into session the first thing Saturday morning, and they were still in session. And when we gathered at the Quai d'Orsay for the first signing of these things on early in the afternoon, 3 o'clock, we didn't know at that time whether they'd come to an agreement or not, or whether this they're all going to blow up. And you can imagine that we were a bit nervous as we stood around there at the Quai d'Orsay with our pens in our hands without knowing whether there was going to be anything to sign or not. The agreement was reached through this intensive effort by these two leaders, and it is another example of how they showed the statesmanship to put first things first and to do away with this age-old problem. So that now we have both the Saar and Trieste as two problems which are settled, I think, and are not going to be unsettling to this European situation.
President, may I ask a question, Secretary? This Paris Agreement have to be ratified by the parliaments of the nations that are involved?
It will have to be. And that gives a chance for the pessimists. I'm not including you, Mr. Attorney General. But it gives a chance for the pessimists to say, well, we're just going to be back where we were 2 or 3 years ago, and we're going to go through the same delays and frustrations. I don't believe that it's going to happen that way this time, because I think what has happened has educated everybody to the fact that there is no alternative this time to this present plan. And furthermore, we've thrown into the scales for positive action some elements that weren't there before. I refer particularly to this pledge by the United Kingdom, which is of tremendous importance. And also, as I say, the Saar and Trieste are no longer there to be unsettling of the whole situation. Mr. Mendes-France, who, by the way, I hope will be coming here a little later on, said repeatedly, it's up to France to make good some of this time that's been lost. And as you probably recall, already after the London conference, and between the London and the Paris conferences, they submitted the basic principles of the London Agreement both to the parliamentary bodies of France and of Germany, and they were approved by a decisive majority. And I think that those facts, coupled with the goodwill and the fellowship which existed through those meetings, and the absence of tension that now is present for the first time almost between France and Germany, are a good augury and are going to indicate that there's probably going to be a positive result. Now, of course, somebody may wonder how the Soviet Union is thinking about this. I think you had a...
tell us, Fields, that the Soviet Union will react to the Paris Agreement particularly.
I agree with you, Ezra, that he ought to tell us just a word on that.
Well, I would say that I feel pretty confident the Soviet Union doesn't like what's going on. Perhaps that's an understatement of the day. What the communists want is a Europe that is weak and divided, and they're going to try to get that, but I don't think that they are going to succeed. This program we worked out, in fact, is going to protect Russia as much as it protects anybody else against the possible resurgence of German militarism. And there's behind this program is a sense of urgency and momentum, so that I don't believe the Soviet Union will be able to break it up. When we create, as I hope we will, a position of solidity and strength for Western Europe, then there may be a new basis for discussion which doesn't exist at the present time. At least we can hope that then there can be talks more satisfactory than those that exist when the only object of the Soviet Union is by trick or device to try and break up European unity.
Mr. President, can I ask a question?
Yes, sir, Secretary Humphrey.
Foster, there's one thing that I'm very interested in that you haven't touched on at all, and that is how much extra cost is there going to be for the United States for this plan?
Mr. Secretary of Treasury, it isn't going to cost us a nickel extra. I'm sure that's a relief to you. This agreement that we arrived at here isn't an agreement that we paid anybody or promised to pay anybody to make. This is an agreement which the Europeans made for themselves, and that is the main feature of the whole arrangement. because the important thing was to demonstrate whether the Europeans had the capacity and the will to arise to a great emergency like this and had a power of decision and a power of action. That's been proved by the fact that this is an agreement which they made, and we're not either by pressures or by inducements or bribes getting anybody to make this. As a matter of fact, it's going to be cheaper for everybody if we can get this agreement through. Now, Mr. President, you've said many times that we had to be, you wanted us to see us play the part of a good partner.
Yes, sir.
And I, of course, partnership is a two-sided affair. And I think that what has happened during these last few weeks has demonstrated that there's a basis for a good partnership on both sides of the Atlantic Ocean. And I want to say one other thing, Mr. President, that as we met there in these gatherings, there was a sense of your spirit being there. Everybody knows that you have understood, as few have, the need for Western European unity, that you've made an immense contribution to it. And if now Europe is going to be strong and united and a protector of its ancient and precious liberties, it's very largely because of what you have done. And I bring that judgment back, not as mine, but as a message which many of these leaders of Europe asked me to bring back here to you. Well, that covers, I guess, the story as fully as it need to be. There's going to be a lot of detailed work has to be done, but that's the main outline of what's
happening. Buster, I feel like we almost ought to give you a standing ovation. You know how intensely I believe that the safety and security of the Western world demanded unity and strength in Western Europe. Now that that has given every promise of coming about, I can't tell you how gratified I am, not just for myself, but for the entire American people. And your colleagues thank you for this brilliant presentation. Really, we do.
Well, thank you very much, sir.
You have been attending an actual session of the President's Cabinet, the first to have ever been broadcast. All members of the Cabinet were present, except Vice President Nixon and Harold E. Stassen, the Foreign Operations Administrator. This combined radio and television industry program has come to you from the Cabinet Room of the White House in Washington, D.C.